A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's a follow-up to something we talked about before, about ballots and the weird economy around them. The question is, if construction dumpsters are probably the safest and most ethical place to find good ballots, what does somebody actually need to know before they go rummaging around in one? The safety? The etiquette? The legal landscape? All of it. For someone who's never done anything like this, where do you even begin?
I love this question because it sits right at the intersection of practical logistics and social awkwardness, which is basically my favorite genre of problem. And the first thing to know is that dumpster diving is not one activity. It's at least three distinct things wearing the same trench coat.
Three things in a trench coat, like a reverse clown car.
You've got residential curb picking, which is what most people picture, someone on a bicycle with a trailer, cruising around on bulk trash day. Then you've got commercial dumpster diving behind retail stores, which is its own subculture with its own unwritten rules. And then you've got construction and industrial dumpsters, which is what the prompt is really pointing at. Different risk profiles, different legal frameworks, different everything.
Let's start with the thing that scares most people off before they even try. Is it legal?
This is where it gets genuinely interesting, because the answer is, it depends on where you are. But in most of the United States, the legal framework is surprisingly permissive if you know what you're doing. The landmark case here is California versus Greenwood, a Supreme Court decision from 1988. The court ruled that once you put your trash out for collection, you no longer have a reasonable expectation of privacy in it. That's a Fourth Amendment ruling. It means the police can search your garbage without a warrant, but it also created the legal foundation for dumpster diving as a protected activity.
The Supreme Court accidentally legalized dumpster diving.
Accidentally legalized dumpster diving, yes, which is the most American thing I can think of. But, and this is a big but, that ruling applies to trash that's been placed out for collection on public property or at the curb. Once you're on private property, reaching into a dumpster behind a locked gate or inside a loading dock area, you're potentially trespassing. And many municipalities have local ordinances that specifically prohibit scavenging, even if the federal constitutional question is settled.
The dumpster behind the shopping center. You're not protected by the Supreme Court there.
Not unless that dumpster is accessible from a public right-of-way without crossing private property. And even then, the property owner can post signs prohibiting the activity, and if you ignore those, you're in trespassing territory. This is why construction dumpsters are actually the sweet spot the prompt is identifying. Construction sites often place their dumpsters right at the curb or in the driveway apron, which is typically part of the public right-of-way. You're not sneaking behind a building. You're standing on what is effectively the sidewalk.
The construction crew probably doesn't care about anything in that dumpster.
That's the second piece of the sweet spot. A retail store might care. They're throwing up merchandise that didn't sell, and some companies have a weird proprietary attitude about their waste. But a construction crew? They paid to have that debris hauled away. Every 2x4 you pull out of that dumpster is weight they don't have to pay to dispose of. You're doing them a favor.
You're a volunteer waste reduction specialist.
Unpaid and unthanked, but yes. And that's the mindset you need. You are not a scavenger. You are diverting usable material from the waste stream. Which brings me to the first practical thing you need to know, and I mean this seriously. You need to know what you're looking at.
Meaning what, specifically?
Meaning construction debris is not just a pile of identical boards. You've got pressure-treated lumber, which is absolutely not something you want to bring indoors or burn. That greenish or brownish tint on lumber? That's chromated copper arsenate or alkaline copper quaternary, chemicals designed to prevent rot and insect damage. The older stuff, pre-2004, often contains arsenic. You do not want to cut that indoors, you do not want to sand it without a respirator, and you definitely do not want to use it for a raised garden bed where you're growing food.
The free lumber might come with free arsenic.
The free lumber might come with free arsenic, and that's not a bargain. Then you've got engineered wood products, oriented strand board, plywood, particle board, which are held together with adhesives that off-gas formaldehyde. Fine for a workshop shelf. Less fine for a headboard you're going to sleep next to for the next decade.
What about pallets specifically, since that's how we got here?
Pallets are their own taxonomy, and I know we covered some of this before, but it bears repeating in the dumpster context. You're looking for the IPPC stamp, the International Plant Protection Convention mark, branded onto the pallet. It'll have a two-letter country code, a registration number, and most importantly, a treatment code. HT means heat treated. That's what you want. MB means methyl bromide. That's a fumigant, and those pallets should not be used for anything except, well, being a pallet.
If there's no stamp at all.
If there's no stamp, it's almost certainly a domestic single-use pallet, probably heat treated by default since most domestic manufacturers moved away from methyl bromide years ago. But you can't be certain. For a construction dumpster application, if you're pulling pallets to build a compost bin or a temporary structure, the treatment question matters less than the structural integrity. You want to check for cracked deck boards, loose stringers, and any sign of chemical staining, dark spots, oily residues, anything that suggests the pallet transported something you don't want in your garage.
Step one is know what you're looking at.
Step two is know when to go. And this is not trivial. Construction dumpsters are active waste streams. They're being filled throughout the workday, and the crew is on site doing their jobs. You showing up at 10 in the morning on a Tuesday to poke around is going to create friction. You're in their workspace, you're a liability concern, and even if they don't care about the waste, they care about some random person being near their equipment.
You go after hours.
You go after hours, or on weekends, or, and this is the real pro move, you go on the day before the dumpster is scheduled to be picked up. That's when it's fullest. The crew is usually gone, and anything you take is literally about to be hauled to the landfill in the next 12 hours. The ethical calculus there is as clean as it gets.
How do you know when pickup day is?
The dumpster will usually have the rental company's name and phone number on the side. You can call and ask casually. Hey, I'm doing some work near the site on Maple Street, just wondering when the dumpster's getting swapped out so I can plan around it. Most dispatchers will tell you without thinking twice. It's not classified information.
That's surprisingly simple.
Most of this is surprisingly simple once you get past the social barrier, which I think is actually the core of what the prompt is asking. The physical and legal logistics are learnable. The real question is, how do you become the kind of person who voluntarily approaches a refuse site?
What is the answer to that?
The answer is that you reframe what you're doing. You're not dumpster diving, you're materials reclamation, you're urban salvage, you're keeping usable goods out of the waste stream. And once you adopt that framing, the stigma starts to dissolve, because you're not acting like someone who's ashamed. You're acting like someone who knows exactly what they're doing and why.
This is the wear a Hy-Vee's vest and carry a clipboard theory of social camouflage.
If you show up to a construction dumpster in a reflective vest with a pair of work gloves and a purposeful demeanor, nobody questions you. You look like you belong there. The clipboard is optional but powerful. I've read accounts from people who've been doing this for years, and the consensus is that looking like you're supposed to be there eliminates about 90% of potential confrontations.
The high-vis vest is the urban invisibility cloak.
And it's not dishonest, really. You are there to work. You're extracting material. You're performing a service, even if nobody asked for it. The vest just communicates that visually to anyone who glances your way.
What about the other 10% of confrontations? What happens when someone does ask what you're doing?
You tell the truth, calmly and without defensiveness. I'm salvaging some lumber for a project. Is that all right with you? Most of the time, the answer is either yes or a shrug. If it's no, you say no problem, have a good day, and you leave. You do not argue. You do not explain why they're wrong. You do not invoke California versus Greenwood. You just leave.
Because the legal framework doesn't matter in the moment.
Because the legal framework doesn't matter, and because the dumpster is their property until it's collected, and because being right and being welcome are two different things. The dumpster diving community has a saying, leave no trace. It means the site should look exactly the same when you leave as when you arrived, except the dumpster might be slightly less full. No scattered debris, no mess, no evidence that you were ever there.
Which is also good practice for not getting the site locked down for everyone else.
One person making a mess and leaving a pile of broken drywall on the ground is how a construction site ends up with a locked gate and a no trespassing sign. The ethics here are important, not just for your own conscience, but for the sustainability of the practice itself.
We've covered the legal framework, the material knowledge, the timing, and the social engineering. What about the actual physical process? You're standing at the edge of a construction dumpster. What do you actually do?
First, you assess from a distance before you even touch anything. Look for hazards, broken glass, protruding nails, anything sharp. Construction dumpsters are full of demolition debris, which means unpredictable edges. You want heavy-duty work gloves, not gardening gloves, not winter gloves, actual cut-resistant work gloves with a grip surface, and you want sturdy closed-toe boots. Steel toes if you have them.
Because tetanus is not a souvenir you want.
Tetanus is not a souvenir, and neither is a nail through the sole of your sneaker. Beyond gloves and boots, you want a headlamp if it's getting dark, and you want a reaching tool, one of those grabber arms that seniors use to pick things up off the floor. That lets you move debris around without actually climbing into the dumpster.
Which you should not do.
Which you should absolutely not do. Never climb into a dumpster. Number one, it's dangerous. You can't see what's underneath you, and a shifted load can pin your leg or worse. Number two, it's undignified, and it looks exactly like what people imagine when they picture dumpster diving. You're not that person. You're the person standing beside the dumpster, reaching in with a tool, extracting specific items with purpose.
The grabber arm is the dignity-preserving device.
The grabber arm is the difference between I'm salvaging materials and I am inside a dumpster. It's a small tool that does enormous psychological work, both for you and for anyone watching.
What about the stuff you actually find? What's worth taking from a construction dumpster?
This is where it gets fun, because construction waste is wildly inefficient. The construction industry in the United States generates about 600 million tons of debris annually, according to the Environmental Protection Agency, and a significant fraction of that is perfectly usable material. You'll find dimensional lumber, 2x4s, 2x6s, that were cut too long or too short and just tossed. You'll find plywood offcuts large enough for shelving or small projects. You'll find PVC pipe, copper pipe, sometimes even intact fixtures if it's a renovation dumpster.
Copper pipe sounds like actual money.
Copper pipe is actual money, though scrapyards will want to know where it came from if you show up regularly with large quantities. For small amounts, a few feet here and there, nobody cares. But if you're pulling 50 pounds of copper out of a single dumpster, you might want to document that you had permission, just in case.
Because copper theft is a real thing, and scrapyards are alert to it.
But for the hobbyist salvager, we're talking about small quantities. A few nice boards, maybe some brick or stone if you're doing landscaping, occasionally something surprising. I've heard of people finding brand new windows still in the packaging because the contractor ordered the wrong size and couldn't return them.
The waste is staggering when you start paying attention.
It really is. And that's part of what makes this ethically interesting. We're not talking about taking something someone wants. We're talking about intercepting usable material on its way to a landfill. There's an environmental argument here that's compelling. Every board you salvage is a board that doesn't need to be manufactured, transported, and purchased new.
Which brings us back to the pallet question from the original episode. The construction dumpster approach sidesteps the ambiguity.
There's no question about whether someone is coming back for that pallet. It's in a dumpster. The dumpster is being hauled away. The pallet's destiny is the landfill. You're not taking, you're intercepting.
Let's talk about the residential side for a moment, because I think people hear dumpster diving and picture something very specific. The person on the bicycle with the trailer, like you said, is that a different activity entirely?
It shares the same legal foundation, California versus Greenwood applies, but the culture is different. Residential curb picking is more about consumer goods than construction materials, furniture, electronics, appliances. The etiquette is more established. You don't make a mess, you don't go through someone's personal documents, you don't knock on the door and ask if they're throwing something away, because that puts them in an awkward position.
Why would that be awkward?
Because people feel shame about waste. If you knock on someone's door and say, "Are you really throwing away that chair?" you're forcing them to confront their own consumption. Even if they're happy for you to take it, the interaction introduces a social friction that most curb pickers prefer to avoid. The unwritten rule is, if it's at the curb on bulk trash day, it's fair game. If you're not sure, leave it.
The curb is the consent mechanism.
The curb is the consent mechanism. It's the universally understood signal that says, I am done with this item, and I am making it available to the waste stream. Whether it goes to the landfill or to your living room is not the original owner's concern.
What about commercial dumpsters? Behind grocery stores? Behind retail? That's the classic image people have.
That's the most legally fraught and culturally controversial form of dumpster diving. Grocery stores in particular throw away enormous amounts of food, perfectly edible, often still packaged, sometimes not even past its sell-by date. In France, supermarkets are legally required to donate unsold food to charities rather than destroy it. In the United States, most of it goes into dumpsters.
The legal situation there?
Most grocery store dumpsters are on private property, behind the building, often behind gates or loading docks. You're almost certainly trespassing. Many stores now use compactors specifically to prevent diving. And some stores deliberately destroy discarded food, pouring bleach over it, for example, to eliminate any question of liability if someone gets sick.
That seems almost aggressively wasteful.
It is, and it's driven by liability concerns, not malice. The store is afraid of being sued if someone eats discarded food and gets ill. The practical reality is that commercial food waste is the hardest category to access ethically and legally. It's also the category where you most need to know what you're doing in terms of food safety, temperature abuse, cross-contamination, packaging integrity. It's not for beginners.
For the person the prompt is asking about, the total beginner who's never done this, construction dumpsters really are the right entry point.
The risk profile is lower. The legal ambiguity is minimal if you're on the curb. The material is more durable and easier to assess. And the social friction is lower because construction crews don't care. You're not confronting anyone's waste shame. You're just pulling lumber out of a box that's about to be hauled away.
Let's get practical. What should a beginner actually bring with them? You've mentioned gloves, boots, a grabber, a headlamp.
A few things. A basic toolkit, a hammer for pulling nails, a pry bar for separating materials that are nailed together, a utility knife for cutting through strapping or plastic wrap. You want a tape measure because there's no point taking a board if you don't know whether it'll fit in your vehicle or your project. You want some kind of tarp or blanket to protect your car's interior because construction debris is dirty and often damp.
Probably a first aid kit.
Absolutely a first aid kit. At minimum, bandages, antiseptic wipes, and tweezers for splinters. Construction debris is Splinter City. And while we're on safety, make sure your tetanus shot is current. I cannot emphasize this enough. A tetanus booster is good for 10 years. If you don't know when your last one was, get one before you start doing this.
Spoken like a retired pediatrician.
But seriously, tetanus is no joke, and it lives in soil and rust and all the things you find in a construction dumpster.
What about the vehicle itself? You're showing up somewhere, possibly at night, loading material into your car or truck. That's a weird look.
It is a weird look, and that's where the social engineering comes back in. If you're driving a pickup truck and wearing work clothes, loading lumber into the back at 7 p.m. on a Saturday, you look like a contractor finishing up a job. Nobody questions it. If you're driving a Prius and wearing khakis, you look like you're doing something unusual. The vehicle is part of the camouflage.
The Prius of suspicion.
The Prius of suspicion, exactly. But more seriously, you need to think about load capacity and tie-downs. Lumber is heavy and awkward. A few 2x4s can easily exceed what a sedan's trunk is designed for. Ratchet straps are cheap and essential. And you need to know how to use them properly. A board through your rear window because you braked hard is not a good outcome.
We've got the gear list. Gloves, boots, headlamp, grabber, basic tools, tape measure, tarp, first aid kit, ratchet straps.
A phone with a flashlight, which you already have. Maybe a friend. Solo dumpster diving at night in an unfamiliar area is not the safest activity in the world. Having someone with you makes it safer and also more enjoyable. Plus, two people can carry longer boards.
The buddy system for refuse exploration.
The buddy system applies to many of life's adventures. This is one of them.
What about the ethics of taking from a dumpster that's on a residential property? Like, someone's doing a renovation and they've got a dumpster in their driveway.
This is a grayer area, and I'd approach it differently. If the dumpster is fully in the driveway, you're on private property the moment you approach it. The better move is to knock on the door during daylight hours and simply ask. I noticed you're doing some renovation work. Would you mind if I pulled a few pieces of lumber from your dumpster before it gets hauled away? Most homeowners will say yes, and some will even be grateful.
Because you're reducing their disposal cost?
Not usually. Residential dumpster rentals are typically a flat fee for a fixed period. But homeowners often feel guilty about the volume of waste a renovation generates. Letting someone salvage usable material alleviates that guilt. It's a small psychological benefit, but it's real.
If they say no...
You say thanks anyway, and you leave. Same rule as always. No arguing, no explaining, no California versus Greenwood.
You mentioned earlier that dumpster diving isn't one activity, but three. We've covered residential curb picking and construction dumpsters. What about the third category? The industrial equivalent the prompt mentions?
The industrial equivalent is where this gets interesting and much less discussed. We're talking about manufacturing facilities, warehouses, distribution centers, places that generate commercial and industrial waste at scale. This is not something a beginner should attempt without understanding the landscape, but it's worth describing because it illustrates how the principles scale.
What's different about industrial waste?
The volume, for one thing. A manufacturing facility might throw away entire pallet loads of material, overstock, discontinued items, packaging changes, minor defects. The waste stream is more predictable and more consistent. But access is much more controlled. These facilities almost always have gated waste areas, security cameras, and employees whose job includes monitoring the premises.
You can't just show up with a grabber and a Hy-Vee's vest?
You cannot, or at least you shouldn't. The approach for industrial waste is relationship-based. You contact a facility manager during business hours. You explain what you're looking for and why. You offer to sign a liability waiver. Some businesses will say no immediately. Others will be curious. A surprising number will say yes, especially if you're taking something specific that they know is perfectly good but can't be sold for whatever reason.
This sounds less like dumpster diving and more like establishing a supply chain.
It is establishing a supply chain. And for people who do this seriously, artists who need large quantities of a specific material, small-scale manufacturers who build things from reclaimed goods, community workshops, this is exactly how they operate. They build relationships with local businesses and become a known part of the waste diversion ecosystem.
The Hy-Vee's vest evolves into a business card.
And at that point, you're not dumpster diving anymore. You're running a materials reclamation operation. The dumpster is just the interface. The real work is the relationship.
Let's bring this back to the beginner, because the prompt is specifically asking about someone who's never done this before. What's the very first thing they should do?
The very first thing is to drive around your own neighborhood on bulk trash day and just observe. Don't take anything. Don't even get out of the car. See what people put out. See who's picking things up. See how the ecosystem works in your specific area. Every city and town has its own rhythm for this. Learning the rhythm is free and risk-free.
The first step is reconnaissance.
The first step is always reconnaissance. After that, pick a specific project that needs a specific material. Don't just go looking for cool stuff. That's how you end up with a garage full of warped plywood you'll never use. Have a plan. I need 4 2x4s and a sheet of plywood for a workbench. Now you know exactly what you're looking for, and you can assess any dumpster against that criterion.
The project constrains the hoarding impulse.
The project constrains the hoarding impulse, which is important. Dumpster diving can become a kind of collecting behavior that's counterproductive. You're saving things from the landfill, yes, but if they're just going to sit in your basement for 5 years, you've only relocated the landfill.
Relocated the landfill is a great phrase.
I've been sitting on that one.
What about the actual moment of extraction? You found the right dumpster, you've identified the right board, it's halfway down the pile. What's the technique?
Patience and leverage. Never yank something out from under a pile. You don't know what's resting on it, and you don't know how the pile will shift. Use your grabber or a long board as a lever to lift material off the top. Work your way down to the item you want. If it's wedged, don't force it. Construction debris can be under tension in ways that aren't visible, and releasing that tension suddenly can be dangerous.
This sounds like the dumpster equivalent of avalanche safety.
It's not that dramatic, but the principle is similar. You're dealing with an unstable pile of heavy, sharp objects. Slow and deliberate wins. And if something seems sketchy, leave it. There's always another dumpster.
Always another dumpster is the dumpster diver's serenity prayer.
It really is. Abundance mindset is key. There is so much construction waste in this country that you will never run out of salvageable material. You don't need to take risks for any individual piece. If it's not easily accessible, move on.
Let's talk about the social dimension a bit more. You mentioned that looking purposeful eliminates most confrontations. But what about the internal experience? The prompt mentions social stigma. How do you actually feel standing there?
The first time, you feel deeply self-conscious. You feel like everyone is looking at you. You feel like you're doing something wrong even when you know intellectually that you're not. This is normal. It fades with repetition. By the third or fourth time, you realize that nobody actually cares. Most people don't even notice you. The ones who do assume you're supposed to be there.
The stigma is mostly internal.
Almost entirely internal. And that's true of a lot of unconventional behaviors. The social penalty you imagine is much larger than the social penalty you actually experience. The high vis vest helps not just because it fools other people, but because it fools you. It gives you permission to feel like you belong there.
The vest is psychological prosthesis.
It's a costume that lets you access a version of yourself that isn't self-conscious about this activity. And once you've done it a few times, you don't need the costume anymore. You've internalized the role.
What about the environmental argument? Is this actually making a difference, or is it a drop in the ocean?
At an individual level, it's a drop in the ocean. But the construction and demolition waste stream in the United States is roughly twice the volume of municipal solid waste, the regular trash that households generate. We're talking about 600 million tons annually. If even a tiny fraction of that is diverted by individual salvagers, the aggregate impact is real. And there's a cultural impact too. Every person who salvages material normalizes the practice. It changes what people consider waste.
The normalization of waste diversion as a cultural practice.
50 years ago, recycling was weird. Now it's weird not to recycle. Dumpster diving for construction materials is where recycling was in the 1970s, a fringe activity that seems vaguely disreputable but is actually ahead of the curve.
Let's get into some specifics about what not to take. You mentioned pressure-treated lumber and anything with chemical staining.
Drywall is generally not worth salvaging unless you need a very small piece for a patch. It's heavy, it's fragile, and it's cheap to buy new. Insulation is similarly not worth it. Fiberglass is unpleasant to handle, and spray foam is impossible to reuse. Anything with visible mold should be left alone, both for your health and because you don't want to introduce mold spores into your home or workshop.
What about metal?
Metal is almost always worth taking if you can separate it. Copper, brass, aluminum, even steel if you have a way to transport it. Scrap metal prices fluctuate, but clean metal is always recyclable and has value. The key word is clean. Scrapyards pay more for metal that's free of attachments, paint, and other contaminants.
You might need to process what you take.
You might, and that's part of the calculation. A door with a brass handle is not brass scrap, it's a door. You have to remove the handle, strip any finish, and separate the materials. That's labor. Whether it's worth it depends on how you value your time.
Which brings us to the economic question. Is this actually saving money, or is it a hobby that feels productive?
For construction materials specifically, it depends entirely on what you're salvaging and what you'd otherwise buy. Dimensional lumber is relatively cheap. New, a 2x4 costs a few dollars. If you're driving across town and spending an hour extracting a half dozen 2x4s from a dumpster, your hourly return is not impressive. But if you're salvaging hardwood flooring, copper pipe, or high-end fixtures, the economics shift dramatically.
It's not a get-rich scheme.
It is absolutely not a get-rich scheme. It's a waste diversion practice that occasionally produces valuable finds. The people who do it seriously are motivated by environmental concerns, or thrift, or the satisfaction of making something from discarded materials. The economic argument is secondary.
Which is fine. Not everything needs to be optimized for financial return.
Not everything needs to be optimized for financial return. Some things are worth doing because they're interesting, or satisfying, or because they align with your values. Dumpster diving for construction materials checks all three of those boxes for the right kind of person.
What kind of person is that?
Someone who enjoys the process of finding and repurposing things. Someone who gets a kick out of the resourcefulness of it. Someone who looks at a pile of discarded lumber and sees a garden bed, or a workbench, or a chicken coop, rather than seeing trash. It's a certain mindset, a combination of practicality and imagination.
The prompt mentions the social stigma of voluntarily approaching a refuse site. I think what you're describing is the antidote to that stigma. If you see opportunity where others see waste, the stigma doesn't land the same way.
The stigma exists because our culture associates waste with disgust. Approaching waste voluntarily violates a deep-seated norm. But that norm is culturally specific and historically recent. For most of human history, nothing usable was discarded. The idea of throwing away perfectly good material is the anomaly, not the practice of salvaging it.
The stigma is the historical aberration.
And I think more people are starting to recognize that. The rise of maker culture, the circular economy movement, the growing awareness of construction, waste, all of these are chipping away at the stigma. In 10 or 20 years, pulling usable lumber from a construction dumpster might seem as normal as taking a shopping bag to the grocery store.
Alright, let's synthesize this for the person who's never done it before. They've listened to this conversation, they're intrigued, they want to try. What's the checklist?
Step 1. Reconnaissance. Drive around, observe, learn the rhythm of your area. Step 2. Pick a project. Know exactly what you're looking for before you go. Step 3. Assemble your kit. Gloves, boots, grabber, headlamp, tools, tarp, first aid. Step 4. Choose your target. Construction dumpsters at the curb after hours or on weekends. Step 5. Dress the part. High-vis vest, work clothes, purposeful demeanor. Step 6. Extract with care. Slow, deliberate, no climbing in, no forcing anything. Step 7. Leave no trace. The site should look untouched when you leave. Step 8. Process your finds. Clean them, denail them, store them properly. Step 9. Build something. The whole point is to use what you salvaged.
That's a solid list. 9 steps from curiosity to completed project.
Step 10, which is optional but recommended, tell someone what you did. Post a photo of the thing you built from salvaged lumber. Be open about where the materials came from. Every person who does this makes it a little bit easier for the next person.
The evangelism of the dumpster.
The evangelism of the dumpster. A noble calling.
One last question. You've been doing this kind of research for a while now. What's the most surprising thing you learned about this world?
The most surprising thing is how organized it is beneath the surface. There are online forums, subreddits, local groups dedicated to dumpster diving. People share tips about specific locations, specific stores, specific dumpster schedules. There's an entire subculture that most people never notice. And within that subculture, there's a strong ethical code. Leave no trace, don't take more than you need, share information freely, don't ruin it for others.
It's a community, not just a solo activity.
It's a community. A weird, decentralized, mostly invisible community of people who have decided that the waste stream is not the end of the line. And once you start seeing it, you can't unsee it. You'll drive past a construction dumpster and instinctively scan for usable material. It rewires your perception.
The dumpster gaze.
The dumpster gaze. It's a real phenomenon.
I think that's a good place to land. We've covered the legal framework, the safety considerations, the social engineering, the ethics, the gear, and the psychology. For someone who's never approached a refuse site before, I think the message is, it's weirder in your head than it is in reality.
The barrier is almost entirely psychological. Once you cross it, you realize you've been walking past free materials your entire life. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1940s, a mantis shrimp specimen collected off the coast of Guyana was observed striking the glass of its holding tank with such force that it shattered a quarter-inch pane. The researchers initially assumed the tank had a manufacturing defect. It did not.
The mantis shrimp broke out of aquarium jail and the scientists blamed the glass.
The scientific method in action. Observe the anomaly, blame the equipment.
That's unsettling.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer Hilbert Flumingtop for keeping the facts flowing and the aquarium glass unreinforced.
If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. It helps other people find the show, including, apparently, people who want to know how to ethically approach a construction dumpster.
Until next time.
We'll be here, probably near a dumpster.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore. A thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.